we return finally to the conflict upon Vigilus, which became part of the Imperium's efforts to traverse the Great Rift and begin to liberate and secure the Dark Imperium, Imperium Nihilus. To do so, the forces of returned Primarch Robute Gilliman, Lord Commander of the Imperium, became aware of a potential point at which to cross the Great Rift, which had so divided the galaxy. This would then become known as the Nachmund Gauntlet. Its importance could not be understated, as it was one of the only stable completed routes found bridging the rift. The world of Vigilus had stood within the side of Imperium Nihilus, and so this world was destined to become a gateway to this crossing. If the Imperium could reinforce the planet quickly enough, then it would likely become a staging point for the entire crusade of Gilliman into the Dark Imperium. So its immediate security was seen as being absolutely critical to the greater efforts of the Imperium in securing and aiding the many thousands of worlds stranded and isolated. However, like moths to the flame, the enemies of mankind had amassed, and soon Vigilus was besieged by the forces of Chaos, Xenos, and traitors in the midst of the Imperial population. Not all of whom were there with foul intentions, for whilst the Orcs and Drakari were simply there to exploit the situation, the cults of the Worm operating on their synaptic suggestions, Vigilus had also attracted those of the Eldari, who hailed from Craftworld Symhan. They had foreseen the importance of the battle here, and so had sent some of their fiercest warriors to tip the scales of fate against Chaos. Often, the immediate benefits of such deployments are not always clear to the Eldar even themselves, but they do understand that any of their farseers would not simply deploy them on such a mission unless it furthered the Craftworld's greater agenda. It's a prime example of how the Eldar may sometimes be seen to form a temporary alliance with humanity, but also not really. Meanwhile, Abaddon, or Abaddon, and other Chaos figures of authority were laying waste to the world. The Warmaster believed that if he could destroy the Noctilith upon Vigilus the Blackstone, this would then lead the Nachmund Gauntlet to collapse, and so they had deployed a massive assault upon Imperial bunker installations, followed up with a vast orbital bombardment to the silos of the Mechanicus which held the Blackstone. This was destroyed, and the Imperials were looking now in extremely bad shape as we reach this stage of the conflict, not to mention the small matter which saw Khalgar, Chapter Master of the Ultramarines, barely survive combat with a greater demon of Chaos. So the strategic situation upon Vigilus was looking extremely fragile, bleak even. And for the massive populations of the Hive Sprawl districts, the planet itself had become nothing less than a complete hellscape, one which was so severe that many were now abandoning all hope of Imperial salvation. The significant conflict so far had devastated the planet. Its human population had seen entire Hive Sprawl areas consumed by Xenos horrors and the abhorrent travesties of the warp, or otherwise just burned out and destroyed. The deployed Astartes and other Imperials were understandably concerned with tactical and territorial control across the planet, not to mention the higher stakes which could very well see the galaxy itself reshaped. It was clear that the fate of ordinary civilians had become an ever-diminishing priority, if it had ever been in the first place. And it's a prime example that would be taught by the Inquisition, though, that being, how do you turn an entire planet's population against the Imperium, which is of course to say abandoning them when they're facing the very worst enemies of humanity. This though is a very difficult situation for any Imperials deployed to a planet under siege, but who only have access to considerably minimal resources. Because any deploying Imperial force, be it Sororitas, Imperial Guard or Astartes, they're going to want to save the billions of human citizens. They're not inhuman monsters. These are loyal Imperial servants. But they also will have specific orders from higher up which will dictate just how feasible this may be. Because unfortunately, when dealing with the severity of threats faced by the Imperium, a single planet could very well end up becoming sacrificed for the greater stability of the thousands of worlds and systems in its immediate vicinity. Vigilus was in a very bad state of affairs at this point. Abaddon had destroyed the Mechanicus silos of Noctilith, the Chaos forces were ravaging the world, orcs rampaging just all over the place, and even Imperial forces were turning back refugee humans, even in some instances upon the wall, firing upon them. The morale then of the general citizenry was not particularly good. In fact, it had been some time since anyone had really paid any attention to themselves or thoughts towards the nobility and the aristocracy for that matter. Those were the self-imposed upper class of Vigilus, who, like so many worlds of the Imperium, of course had made every effort to isolate themselves from the chattering, unwashed masses below. Their level of contempt shown from the very earliest signs of trouble upon Vigilus, including its general mismanagement, through to the inability in detecting extremely dangerous cultists in its midst, even prior to the Great Rift, were just some of the many significant red flags which pointed towards the nobility of Vigilus being far more of a burden than they ever were a benefit. They certainly cared none for those who existed far below themselves, which, to be clear, was not anything out of the ordinary, but when facing an assault of threats as Vigilus had, it would have been even in their own self-interests to have done so, or at least had agents working on their behalf who could have provided even moderately accurate intelligence. So almost inevitably, the planet beset by a number of different enemies, with millions of citizens dying of starvation, and now the gravitic curse Abaddon had levelled against the planet, creating this extreme lack of water, things were looking absolutely dire. For citizens, ordinary survival was bad enough, and that's if they weren't being consumed by horrifying plagues or tortured by different kinds of nightmarish horrors from the warp, or just general traitor Astartes and Xenos. With all of this going on, it surely felt the right time for the previously powerful members of the planet's nobility to twist the knife in. At this point in the conflict, the cults which had existed on Vigilus were already swollen by an exponential growth in new membership from the many citizens who had essentially abandoned all hope in the face of inevitable death, in what we might consider as an extremely understandable sequence of decisions. They had chosen to roll the dice on siding with the enemy, something that would be problematic for the defending Imperials, who already had enough to deal with in the form of traitor Astartes and mouth-frothing orcs looking to basically fight anything in sight. But now the exploding numbers of ramshackle human cultists was not something anyone needed at this point from the defenders' point of view. However, their lack of appeal to the populace at other stages of the conflict had largely caused this situation, and so the problem rested entirely upon their shoulders. Unlike the pleb masses, the situation on Vigilus, as dire as it was, had been surprisingly tolerable to the aristocracy, though not seen as being particularly a priority or a threat to the invaders. The nobility had been pretty much left alone, having sealed themselves away behind vast bastion vaults which protected them, and offered little in the way of productive contributions to defenders. So similarly to the traitors, the loyal Astartes who had arrived and others had just allowed them to basically sit out the war so far in their entombed luxury. For they had stockpiled truly immense quantities of supplies, enough that it could have lasted hundreds of lifetimes. All this while the population outside were turning upon each other in the search for even the smallest scraps of sustenance. The nobility felt absolutely no obligation to supply the population with any of their stored supplies, even going so far as to equip high-tech Spira warsuits to descend and prey upon the representatives of Mortward's poorer classes when they petitioned for a fairer spread of resources. So things steadily deteriorated. The nobility were content to remain very comfortable as they waited for this particular storm to pass. Yet the possibility of that becoming a reality was, unbeknownst to the aristocracy, looking ever more precarious with each passing hour. And this did nothing to diminish the expanding forces of cultists who pledged allegiance to either the Tyranid Worm Cult or the Chaos factions, and who were also making a lot of noise in their surrounding areas. Even their own peasantry were putting forward representatives who were successfully causing unity in the cults and then triggering uprisings about the lack of base resources for their survival. It was a vicious cycle. Now, spirers, of course, were normally used for a kind of ritual ceremony in the nobility across hive worlds, but it also is used in a kind of weird sport where spirers can descend to hunt dangerous criminals or just general undesirables. It's grim, distasteful activity that undoubtedly some of the upper class enjoy perhaps a little too much. But now they had been seen to use these spirers effectively in assassinating any of the rebelling populace who got a little too vocal about their wealthy higher-ups and just what they had locked away behind their well-protected inner bastion keeps. But for as fast as the noble spirers could eliminate this leadership, the rioting continued. And to make matters worse, their selfish decadence at the expense of others' most basic needs was causing the deaths of hundreds, if not thousands, of citizens. In fact, it had become so extreme that it began to attract the attention of not the Imperial Administratum or other senior overseers, all of whom were far too concerned with the other ongoing wider situation. No, they began to attract the followers of decadence, of She Who Thirsts Most. So this situation became a prime example of how Slaanesh can appear not always at those who fall to the most carnal of pleasures. As I've talked about quite recently, Slaanesh is the god of excess, and this can take many forms. A perverse level of selfishness, for example, a sheer abhorrent disregard for the citizens that saw deliberately imposed suffering placed upon others at the unnecessary luxury of the nobility. The actions of the aristocracy in this situation were so egregious they began to attract the scions of Slaanesh to their doors. And with the war raging outside now at its peak, the Astartes on the front lines battling for every scrap of ground they could cover, the planet's militia and guard forces engaged with suppressing the rising numbers of rampaging, rioting cultists that these aristocrats had in large part contributed to creating, there would be none who were available or even aware of the need to now save them. The traitors of the flawless host had quite calmly appeared at the bastion doors, having sensed the depths of human depravity on display, attracted like moths to the lamp. In their acts of self-indulgent, morally devoid, ego-driven suffering, which had been inflicted upon the helpless and, in many respects, the innocent, it was enough to attract the attention of the followers of Slaanesh, certainly, but as they would soon discover, and to their horror, for all the wrong reasons. Because their actions in the eyes of the flawless host were not celebratory, but let's say on the right track. They were leaning toward becoming excessive, corrupt, and abhorrent. But in the eyes of Slaanesh, their disgusting selfishness was also pitifully lacking. They had walked right up to the door of Slaanesh, but failed so miserably to put on a display worthy of the Dark Lord that more than just being denied entry, their efforts were just offensive. Clearly, they must be shown what was required to satisfy even the most basic desires of the cult followers and scions of Slaanesh. It took very little effort for the aligned Astartes to enter what the aristocracy had presumed to be an impenetrable fortress to the outside situation, and now they would be shown, willing or not, in visceral terms, what indulging in selfish excess truly meant. What followed was apparently so obscene and disgusting to humanity, there exists no record of what was perpetrated upon the lords and ladies of the vigilous aristocracy of Mortwald. Of course there isn't, because it's Slaanesh, as I also talked about recently. But they would be shown with no constraint what it truly meant to experience excess. Slaaneshi demonettes were said to have been seen moving and appearing whenever there were any attempts by guard regiments or cultists to breach or interfere with the prolonged suffering taking place within the private realm of the privileged few. Unfortunately for the citizenry outside, they, of course, gained no advantage from the situation, and while they may have appreciated the ironic fate being meted out upon the elite, such crumbs of comfort cannot fill a bloated, empty stomach, nor could it wet parched lips or soothe infected sheaths of skin. Elsewhere, for those who had maintained enough energy to still display rage at being denied access to resources, aligned cults or just bands of outraged citizenry overwhelmed militia and their defensive blockades. So that in a very short space of time, the heads of their so-called leaders were being paraded, displayed, or otherwise defiled. Vigilus was very much disintegrating in all respects. And so these acts of wanton bloodlust inevitably pulled some into the waiting arms of the dark gods of chaos. The citizenry may have remained loyal had the nobility merely rationed out the more than substantial stockpiles that they had locked away. But instead now hordes of new chaos worshippers threw themselves like some tide of corruption against the Imperials whenever the traitor Astartes would engage them. For the few defenders who remained and Kalgar's Imperial Astartes, Vigilus had now reached a terminal inflection point, albeit one which had been clearly approaching for some time. The defenders had been on the back foot already from the beginning, their forces were minimal and decisions continually bogged down with secondary considerations or delusional hopes of victory. The planet was also ablaze, a vast smog choking the air and atmosphere, resources were sparsely available and Xenos raiders seemingly could appear anywhere at any time. But throughout the entire Vigilus defensive campaign, the Imperials had really only amassed minimal victories. Many of the original objectives and assets they had attempted to salvage were lost. The spires of the Hives, Dirkden, Mortwall, Dontoria, all were collapsing. The Void Claw had ravaged the planet's water, among other disruptive environmental consequences, which were destroying the planet, basically. And the populace felt abandoned and suffered appalling levels of casualty. So looking at the state of play, the Despoiler arrogantly began to ignore the Imperials, because in effect he considered the world already his. It certainly seemed as if this were the case, for many of the Imperials' worst fears were becoming confirmed. After the loss of the Blackstone upon the world, reports began to appear that the rift itself was now beginning to steadily encroach toward and seemingly would eventually swallow Vigilus into the rift. Astropaths reported seeing lucid dreams and visions of a monstrous hand crushing a throat. The Nachmand gauntlet was beginning to close, just as Abaddon had planned. Few Imperials were under any illusions of the insurmountable obstacles they still faced, but Gilliman had decreed that Vigilus would not fall, and so now they had nothing left to lose. Up until this point, the Imperial defenders had been attempting to spin multiple plates. They were saving the planet, defeating enemy forces, minimizing population loss. Most of these were now clearly unviable, and only a Pyrrhic form of ultimate victory could be entertained. Yet the Despoiler had made a miscalculation in disregarding what was left of the Imperial defenders. For an opponent can never be more dangerous than when they have nothing left to lose. And so now the Imperials would begin to focus and use their forces with little regard for their preservation than they may have before, because many understood that their survival now was very unlikely, something which certainly helped to focus both their minds and efforts. They debated and discussed all remaining options. They looked at further quarantines, the destruction of sites which were on the borderline of salvation or collapse if it meant destroying a number of enemy at the same time. Even the word exterminatus was thrown around. The only positive was that the orcs and cultists of the Pauper Princes had been taking a heavier toll on the Chaos forces. Similarly to the war zone of Octarius, though, this really didn't benefit the Imperials in the long term, because it simply meant emboldened enemies who would eventually turn upon them, but in the short term, it did boost morale incrementally, and it kept the Chaos forces distracted and unable to focus on completely annihilating what remained of the Imperials. Kalgar and his Senate, though, still remained, and they had repeatedly made determinations as to the outcome of this conflict. For now, the writing was on the wall. They were so significantly outnumbered, and their existing forces so damaged, that even fighting to the last man would leave them facing total destruction. So Kalgar would eventually conclude a course of diplomacy which drew inspiration from his Primarch, for since Gilliman's return to the Imperium, he had made many public displays which made those among the senior leadership very uncomfortable, that is, neutral alliances with the Xenos, namely the Eldari. Kalgar had settled on a conclusion that they had never wished to consider, that they needed an unpalatable alliance, just as demonstrated by Gilliman, to win this war. The Orcs were an obvious non-starter, and despite past historical instances where humanity had loosely worked alongside the Greenskins, usually through circumstance more than diplomacy, the Orcs upon Vigilus were so frenzied that at this point it would be a pointless endeavour and likely end up in just more deaths and waste. Similarly, the Genestealer cultists of the Pauper Princes were so abhorrent, alien, and their overall goals disgusting that to even consider appealing to their kind was both pointless and a criminal step too far. The Imperials would just face death rather than the dishonour of considering the assistance of those wretched mutants. So one option remained, and unpalatable as it may be, the grave situation still existed. The chances of Imperial reinforcements reaching Vigilus were near non-existent. The importance of Vigilus and the Gauntlet, incalculable. So the name Eldari was the only one which seemed feasible. The Eldar, though, upon Vigilus, were not those from the more diplomatic and measured of craft worlds. Many of the Imperial commanders and even Kalgar's personal guard had already witnessed that those upon the planet hailed from Saimhan, who you will remember were present in the early engagements of this conflict. They had approached and descended to Vigilus after their seers placed importance in their great war against the most bitter enemy, Chaos. Now, in the earlier stages of the Vigilus conflict, and as humans are not particularly known for their care to discern between Xenos subfactions, the Craftworlders had been mistaken for Drakari, who had already been raiding the world. The then Aquilarian Council, before Kalgar had arrived, had seen it appropriate to deploy Imperial Guard against a force that, unbeknownst to them, was likely aiding them. And this caused the death of one of the Eldar leaders, which then triggered Saimhan to turn upon the Imperials ever since. The outlook was certainly then not helped by the fact that Lieutenant Orthus of the Ultramarines had later been caught up in fighting with the Eldari, having hoped to make some kind of truce with the ferocious yet honourable warriors, but on that day it was not to be, for the Eldar had only vengeance in their mind, and so the Astartes were forced to defend the Vigilus Command headquarters from destruction at the hands of the Craftworlders, and this saw only more losses inflicted upon the Eldar, which did not improve relations. But in the time since, little had been heard from the Eldar, other than periodic raids and assaults. Still, attempting to form an alliance with Saimhan remained unlikely at best. But now there was no alternative. By the second night of the immense gravitic forces and Vulian anomaly steadily breaking the planet, and the now encroaching Nachmund Gauntlet, Kalgar knew time had run out. The chattering objections made by Korea Militarum and Senate leadership members echoed still in his mind, as with his Victrix guard by his side, Kalgar marched out from the council chambers to where the Eldar forces had been steadily assaulting Hyperia Hivesprawl in recent days. Seemingly, the Eldar remained engaged in this war of vengeance with the Imperials, and were currently fighting against the elite Tempestus and some Sororitas. Kalgar approached and found an opportune pause in the engagement. He stood so as to make himself visibly and audibly known to the enemy, for he knew that despite the Eldari still having a score to settle, with the deaths of several of their high-ranking officers, and being also of the more aggressive Saimhan Eldar, they were also still Eldar, which meant they were intelligent, curious, and open-minded enough to see his presence and consider why he would present himself in this manner, here and now, and that this situation could perhaps aid them in the broader context of the conflict, for they themselves understood the critical importance of Vigilus and the Nachmund Gauntlet. Nothing had changed in that regard. One Farseer Kaltok would meet with Kalgar, for they also understood that failure for the Imperium here meant to doom the Imperium Nihilus, and with Chaos able to control near one-third of the galaxy unchecked, their greatest enemy would reap the rewards, and they would likely face terrifying consequences as well. A ceasefire was called. Within the walls of the Saints Haven Command, Kalgar made an impassioned speech that was in places a little heavy on the illustrious praise for the Imperium, Macragge, and the threats they faced, but his mention of an Eldari god of the dead, Inaid, and the priestess who led that cause, Ivrain, this caught sharply the attentions of even the most resistant Saimhan warriors. The specifics between Khalgar and Kaltok were not recorded by Imperial historians, and any other records of this meeting were purged. What was known, though, is that the Eldar accompanied Khalgar back to the Vigilus Senate, the doors barred with his Victrix guard outside, and that from that day forward, notable members of the council were never seen again. The same council members who had ordered the assault upon the Saimhan, leading to the loss of significant members among the Eldar leaders. Which, when considered through a narrow lens, makes objective sense for the Imperium, but it also aligns with many other uncomfortable historical instances. If we cast our minds back across 10,000 years, it marks just another situation of the Imperium's staunch principles and laws, as dictated even by Khalgar's Primarch, only being actually applicable if they are convenient. As was the case upon Terra with the Provost Marshal of the Arbites, Kandawire. She presented Valdor with her evidence of the atrocities committed against the Thunder Warriors, and for her efforts was summarily dismissed. When she refused to abandon her investigations, she was also exiled. So it's well established that despite all the Imperium purports itself to be, this is most often in actuality a gross facade riven with hypocrisy. Anyway, I was very close to going off on a wild tangent there, but the point as always is, there are definitely two sides to the Imperium, as we have discussed, two sides to the Emperor. All of this, though, is entirely irrelevant for the likes of Khalgar, whose singular objective at this point was to secure Vigilus, not to save it, and to also retain control of what remained of the Nakmund Gauntlet, if it could not be prevented from imploding and being swallowed by the Cicatrix Maledictum, that is. So now with their new allies, they set about quickly assessing how they could make the most effective gains against the enemy with the still minimal resources they had available. Now, you can say what you like about the Eldari, untrustworthy, weak in comparison to the Imperials, but when making this alliance, they did not by any means hold back the aid given. One of their very significant loans of hardware was a near to invisible stealth vessel known as Vor's Ghost. This had plagued Imperial shipping in the region for decades. Khalgar now intended to use it to launch an intercepting raid against the vengeful spirit. His gamble was that he understood, and perhaps one of the few Imperials here who could understand, the value that Abaddon placed upon this ship. The vengeful spirit held significant value to him, both in its literal strength and power, but also the fact that few ships from this era survived. It was a relic, more of a symbol in this time than it had been even during the Heresy, and this had already been well proven in this conflict alone. Its continued presence in orbit had continually intimidated the Imperial fleet enough that they had dared not even attempt further engagements. But it was also a very highly symbolic vessel for the Despoiler to control, in the sense that this was the ship of Horus Lupercal, the ship which the Emperor himself was fatefully wounded upon. Khalgar well knew there was no possibility that Abaddon would entertain the loss of this vessel, and it was his hope that if they could put some pressure upon the vengeful spirit, it could cause at least some miscalculations, perhaps even the withdrawal of the Black Legion forces, and at the absolute best, perhaps for Chaos to leave the world entirely. The new broader strategy they would now deploy involved the highly skilled lightning-fast riders of Saimhan, who would continue on with the Imperial plans of driving their great enemy of Chaos to engage against the weight of numbers of the Greenskins and Cultists. Even though combined, the Eldar and Loyalists still did not have the weight of numbers to contend in any real sense with these threats. But if the Chaos threat could be removed, they would have a fighting chance, and they could then drive the Xenos together. The Iron Warriors had been making steady progress, though, breaking through Imperial defences at Mortwald, and presented one of the most heavy threats at the current time. So the Saimhan Wild Riders would engage there first, baiting the raging Orc Speed War, which had continued on, to the rear of the Iron Warriors' line, thereby trapping them between the frenzied Orcs and the Imperials. the problem being that the Eldar anti-grav skimmers were so incredibly fast, they regularly had to slow down to enable the orcs to catch up, but thankfully being orcs, their enthusiasm to catch the Eldar never diminished. Eventually, the merry chase of wild riders led the speedwar to plough straight into the maw of the Iron Warriors, who had been grinding their way into the Imperial lines. At the very last moment, the Eldar riders flew vertically up, escaping away and leaving the raging orcs, who had only become steadily more thirsty for a fight, straight into the traitors. This assault and the general strategy was far more successful than they had anticipated, especially when the wave serpents of the Eldar led a mass of orc blitz brigades straight into the super heavy assets and traitor titans of Legio Decapitorum. Just as Khalgar had planned, the traitors were now caught between a single-minded, well-disciplined Imperial line, minimal and thin on resources as it was, and a frenzied, bloodthirsting rampage of orc insanity behind them. This simple capture manoeuvre was still only part of the plan. All of this destruction occurring had enabled Khalgar to enter and seize what he'd sought from the Mortwald aerial base. Amid a fleet of Valkyrie, they had extracted a few pieces of critical weaponry that were demanded by Khalgar, that he had forced from the clutches of Grand Castellan Danos. Deathstrike missiles, even two suspected to have Vortex warheads. But acquiring these Deathstrike missiles had been a two-stage process, the first being locating Lord Danos, who had been heavily dug in within the sprawl of Mortwald, and who had somehow avoided the worst ravages of the flawless host that were meted out upon the bulk of the aristocracy by the followers of Slaanesh. But despite it being at the request of Khalgar himself, Danos had flatly refused to release the, in his words, mint condition missiles from the gene vault they were stored within. He explained that they were for viewing, not for firing, and that furthermore, he would invoke any legal and bureaucratic means to slow down and ensure that Khalgar's requisition would not be authorised. An incredulously enraged Khalgar grabbed the Lord by his arms, breaking them in the process, and simply asking again for the weapons in a sterner and more intimidating tone. Lord Danos agreed to unlock the gene-coded vaults, and with hours, the weapons were secured. Above Vigilus, for the first time since the arrival of the traitors, the Imperial fleet began to engage. This came to the total confusion of the Chaos fleet, who could not begin to fathom the logic of what they hoped to achieve here. It was surely the last-ditch effort of desperate fools. Yet despite taking as high as 80% losses, the efforts of the Imperial vessels were enough that it at least seemed some kind of serious effort of an enemy with their back to the wall and no options left than some other kind of distraction. The Imperial ships would take raiding shots, they prodded and poked the Chaos ships, they dealt damage where they could and navigated with their expertise to minimise damage. Nonetheless, they still took a terrible toll, their lives were sacrificed for the final efforts of Khalgar's last gambit. This successfully created the impression in the eyes of the Chaos fleet that the assault of the Imperial ships was very sincere, for they saw no other reason for them to have engaged and taken such losses otherwise. The defending Imperials had no other weapons or ships, no reinforcements anywhere close to approaching, and so these actions were the last flailing efforts of a desperate, defeated foe. The unknown truth, of course, to the overconfident, almost apathetic crew of the Chaos fleet, would be something they could have never imagined. For even as they effortlessly repelled the Imperial fleet, the Eldari stealth vessel Vor's Ghost was ever slowly approaching the vengeful spirit, unseen, undetected, unmolested. Inside it held its precious payload of Deathstrike missiles, critically some of these designated as Vortex missiles.
It seems so long ago now that the Death Guard first infected Dontoria, emerging from their dropship before immediately descending into the shadows of the city to spread their foul corruption. Nurgle, the god of plagues, disease, and despair, is known to touch nearly all regions of the galaxy. Even I myself have been unable to escape from its influence, hence you hear now how my voice has been reshaped by the power of the warp. for it would seem that even the changer Zinch was unable to shield me from the great infections of Grandfather Nurgle. Within Dontoria, despite repeated firebombing attempts and kill teams sent into the city, the diseased could not be cauterized, and as Vigilus became deluged by the enemies of humanity during the onset of the War of Nightmares, the followers of Nurgle boiled out of their hiding places once more. As we had noted earlier, the seeds of disloyalty sown by the apathetic nobility easily turned the loyal servants of the Imperium to other causes, and the fear instilled by the infamous broadcast ultimatums of Harkon Worldclaimer cast out yet more seeds of doubt and despair, seeds that would soon be nourished by the plagues of the Death Guard, led by one plague surgeon Zocalinsis, who brought the Gallipox here to Dontoria. In some of the other regions of Vigilus, Death Guard would break away. One Gerlok Thrax introduced the Dolorous plague strain to the great city of Hyperia, but this would be extinguished surprisingly by the appearance not of more Imperials but indeed of the Thousand Suns. But despite the greatest quarantine efforts of the Imperial Guard within Dontoria, they could not prevent the smaller organisms and flies which spread the plague so virulently, that by the time the final battles for Vigilus were taking place, it was now unclear who remained in control of Dontoria. While Abaddon had his own objectives, the Death Guard here were tasked with spreading the plagues of Nurgle far and wide, and if possible, their greater plot was to use the Nachman Gauntlet to further the Gallipox to the Imperium Sanctus, which really demonstrates how different Chaos forces can have entirely different objectives, and may even fight against one another to achieve them, because Chaos is not a united force necessarily. They're often working with completely different agendas and moving in entirely different directions, often deliberately fighting against one another. Such is the great game of the Chaos Gods. And while the Warmaster may have wished to close the Nachman Gauntlet, the Death Guard wished for it to remain open so that it may exist as a conduit to infect and spread the contagions of Nurgle far and wide. Freighters full of infected mutants were dispatched into space, some of them even reaching the Vigilus Mandeville point. And despite the best efforts, as we remember, of rogue trader de Languille, these plague vessels made translation into the warp. But Dontoria had, for the many years of the Vigilus conflict, remained a deeply problematic region. But now an even more unforeseen situation would come forward. A schism among the Death Guard and the Chaos ranks. A group appeared known simply as the Purge. They were a powerful band of renegades and followers of Nurgle who had made planetfall in eastern Dontoria. They had found it utterly repulsive. The heretic Astartes of this strange brotherhood believed in the destruction of all forms of life, for since their fall to the ruinous powers, they saw all living things as either corrupt or potential vessels for corruption. They believed that all natural forms were so inherently flawed that only by extinguishing all life in the galaxy could a new order rise, and that the quickest way to achieve this was with poison and pandemic, a fairly extreme stance even by the standards generally seen among the Death Guard and followers of Nurgle. When the Purge made planetfall amid the industrial centres of Dontoria, within they soon slaughtered the infected Gallipox and uncontaminated Hive citizens with indiscriminate fire. They loaded the bodies into the industrial furnaces, to which they added foul, black, greasy concoctions of unknown origin, which unleashed toxic smog that few could breathe and survive for long. Many thousands in nearby districts would succumb to this heavy, unavoidable miasma which descended and spread through the regions of Dontoria. Even plant life, where it existed still, withered and turned to black, lifeless forms. The Purge would repeat this process as they gained ground and spread through the hive spore with each new assault. The black smog would descend to passively eradicate adjacent areas. Eastern Dontoria had become an eerie, lifeless, ashen city, empty, ghostly, silent. There were no bizarre Nurgle creations to be seen here, just a soot-blackened wasteland with skeletal remains hanging from their last clawing positions, or others where they had simply fallen,
the strange mutated forms of the Gallipox mixed in among them. The Death Guard, who had come to Vigilus long ago now, and who had spent so long cultivating the Garden of Nurgle in Dontoria, witnessed this smog of death, and were displeased. But when they discovered the active eradication of the Gallipox, there was no other option than war against those they may have at one time called brother. They besieged the citadels of the Purge and laid waste to them in fashions that even the Iron Warriors may have had cause to respect. But for the citizens of Dontoria and any Imperials who had remained trapped attempting to restrain or liberate areas of the city, all hope had faded. For Moneas Khalgar had far greater concerns, and Abaddon certainly did not seek to interrupt the vice-like lock the two Death Guard forces had upon one another. For the Imperium and any left within the walls of Dontoria, the city had fallen. Any within were now abandoned. Finally, the war that had fallen upon Vigilus for so many years was now entering its final chapter. Khalgar had gambled that a direct challenge to the vengeful spirit could finally tip the scales, but it was a very high-risk strategy with no guarantees, something many of Khalgar's allies were all too aware of. They then had to come up with an alternative, something that could give them a fighting chance, a wild card to strengthen their hand. Khalgar presented to them all the only other option he knew, as entirely unpalatable as it was. Many hesitated to endorse it, yet the dire state of the planet left no alternative. Saint's Haven was ravaged, its population reduced to a fraction by the relentless wars with Xenos invaders and Chaos traitors. Each fleeting victory seemed only to birth new threats, despite all the escalating chaos. Khalgar rejected the now more prominently voiced but altogether devastating option of Exterminatus. But the debates grew ever more heated, with Raquelon Xantus, Chapter Master of the Necropolis Hawks, even having the audacity to invoke the Codex Astartes to challenge Khalgar's course, a shocking affront to the Chapter Master of the Ultramarines, but also entirely representative of the strength of feeling other Astartes who were present felt they were required to voice. Khalgar, though, stood firm. He saw no other way forward, and would respond to the criticisms of others with the clearly stated, no less demanded, words of the Primarch: Vigilus would not fall. Khalgar's plan: to challenge the Warmaster directly. His other plans were already set in motion, and the time was approaching that would see the commands of Gelimon fulfilled or lying in abject failure. No doubt the latter would see Khalgar himself and most if not all the Loyalists perish thereafter. So in his mind there was very little to lose. Morale was already about as low as it could be, near to collapsing, and here now was a chance to deal a blow that could determine the course of the war, and indeed the broader picture across the entire galaxy. So such a move would have been unthinkable and likely nowhere near as effective early into the conflict, but at this specific juncture, the damage it could wield to an overconfident enemy was nothing to underestimate, and in many ways Khalgar considered this an essential part of his greater plan. He also felt sure that this would be an offer Abaddon could not turn down, if not for his own ego, then certainly to hold his position in the eyes of other traitors. Khalgar climbed atop the highest levels of Saint's Haven, and using the Ecclesiarchy vox speakers issued the challenge. Knowing it would be fully picked up by the traitors, he publicly issued the challenge for Abaddon to face him in single combat. Hearing of this news, the Warmaster wore an evil grin of comedic dark delight. Such an opportunity and such a foolish proposal. The weapons he wielded were those of legend, the Talon of Horus himself, a weapon that had slain a Primarch no less. How could a Chapter Master possibly hope to stand against such reckless hate? When the Warmaster and his elite Terminators, complete with demon-possessed thralls, teleported to the highest levels of Saint's Haven, Khalgar stood before them, unprotected by the arcane technologies that had until now shielded him from assassination attempts throughout the Vigilus War. Abaddon, the War Master of Chaos, strode forth from the blinding light that erupted before Khalgar. The Ultramarines that stood backing him engaged with the Terminators of the Black Legion. As soon as they emerged, they bashed with shields, laying down cracking bolt of fire. Their only goal, though, in this action, to separate the War Master from his chosen warriors. Many of these ancient traitors soon would lay bleeding out upon the ivory stone floors of Saint's Haven, as the skies above them were a hellish red and black, as if the world itself were ablaze. Khalgar and Abaddon engaged in their duel. The Chapter Master dodged, feigned attacks, picked moments to thrust forward and when to fall back. Despite the massive bulk of his powered suit, the armour of Heracles gave greater movement than one would have presumed at a superficial glance. He was able to move and evade the worst attacks of the War Master, while still opening up with bolts from the gauntlets of Ultramar whenever an opportunity presented itself. Most of all, he hid from the deadly blade of the War Master, Drachnian. These initial rounds were, though, merely testing one another, learning and watching, feeling the timing and movement of the other so as to learn best when to fully commit and deploy all their strength into an assault upon the other. Khalgar was measured, cautious, but engaged with the confidence one would expect from a Chapter Master of the Ultramarines. He had to ensure that Abaddon felt he could win, that he could overcome him and claim this victory. To force an early retreat would defeat the purpose of the battle. Khalgar needed the War Master here, in this place, away from the vengeful spirit. Abaddon, more used to direct engagements across thousands of years ever since the grinding slaughter of the heresy upon Terror, was becoming frustrated with the constant evasions and lack of committed engagement from Khalgar. He let fly with his combi bolter, the rounds screaming from the talon of Horus, in enveloping the Chapter Master. An unpredictable misstep by Khalgar as a flagstone shifted under his weight gave Abaddon an opportunity, and he was there instantly. He set upon him with the talon of Horus, ripping clean away one of Khalgar's gauntlets. His forearm splintered and torn of its skin, Khalgar responded with an immense punch from his other fist. He hit Abaddon with such force it shattered his jaw, and then another came. Abaddon was lifted from the ground as his Terminator armor breastplate cracked open. The War Master was shaken. What should have been a trivial duel to just notch up another win across a score kept for 10,000 years had already become a considerable irritation. He screamed in disgust as tendrils of demonic flame licked all around the blade of his sword. It came thrusting to Khalgar. He blocked it, but even as he deflected it, two of his fingers were severed cleanly and the impact cracked open even more of Khalgar's armor from the transfer of energy. The sword cut through and slashed at the Chapter Master's hearts. Khalgar slumped to the ground. Suddenly, Abaddon's attention was laser-focused upon an incoming Vox message. Harkon Worldclaimer delivered unthinkable news to the War Master. The vengeful spirit was critically damaged. It could be destroyed at any moment, and they were initiating immediately emergency warp translation. This, he heard, was the only hope remaining to salvage the symbolic vessel. Abaddon was stricken with grief, confusion, and outrage. Although Khalgar lay before him, defeated, the War Master was interrupted before he could finish the act. The culmination of the Chapter Master's plans and sacrifice became clear. Abaddon's sword screamed tortured demonic utterances of denial as the War Master was forced to retreat and recalled to the vengeful spirit, the vessel he prized above all else, even above the Blackstone fortresses he had claimed throughout the Black Crusades. He knew that if he were not aboard as it translated to warp space, there was a chance he may never see it again. And so, as crimson flames enveloped the War Master and his entourage, just as they had arrived, they were gone. The misshapen horrors of the warp, though, remained. Possessed fiends stalked Khalgar's remains. They approached him as would scavengers of the dead, and the Lord of the Ultramarines lay open to attack, his skin white, pale, his body broken, his hearts open. Yet Khalgar was not the man he once was. Just as all who had crossed the Primaris Rubicon, he held strength unknown by those of the traitors. His Belisarian furnace ignited, the creation of its namesake Mechanicus Archmagos. It gave him the ounce of strength needed to hold back the dark embrace of death. He rolled to his knees, and despite the Victrix guard holding back the warp monstrosities, some still slipped through. Khalgar raised his remaining gauntlet of Ultramar, battering away the creatures and opening fire with a salvo of bolts against others who came upon him. It was all he could muster, but it was all that was required. He fell back to the ground. His personal guard moved to form a shield wall around the body of the Chapter Master, and a Stormraven gunship came into view. Its front ramp already opened, apothecaries jumping clear to aid Lord Khalgar. They were instantly to their work, a flurry of Narthesiums and elixirs to stabilize and fill his grievous wounds until he could be returned to the chambers of the Apothecarium. He gave a final instruction to the remaining Ultramarines. Take the fight to the streets and destroy the traitors. Khalgar was removed from the field to undergo immediate and extensive life-saving operations. He would not be seen on the battlefields of Vigilus for a considerable time after, but he continued as commander from the Vigilus Senate. And while he had failed to overcome the Warmaster in single combat, the odds were always significantly stacked against him. What he had achieved was far more important. The denial of the world to the forces of chaos, and a strategic exploitation that he knew would cut more deeply into the Warmaster across the centuries to come than any physical wounding. Yet Vigilus was still not yet won. It remained a battle to be lost for the Imperium, and it was not one merely of victory, but indeed of their very survival. The aftermath, seen in the shadowed retreat of the vengeful spirit, reshaped the war on Vigilus. It may not have meant anything approaching certain victory for the Imperials, but it did change the face of the battles to come. Planetside, word of Abaddon and the Gloriana-class ship's retreat sparked confusion and disorder among the Chaos ranks, much as it had done some 10,000 years previous in the conclusion of the Heresy. To say there was panic might have been an overstatement, but certainly those who remained on Vigilus saw little sense in remaining here now so many objectives were already achieved. Suddenly their own preservation became the primary focus. In orbit of the planet, the Imperial Navy stood crippled, but it persevered. Its heavily diminished fleet was to be then bolstered by ships drawn from nearby systems and worlds. This exposed some to weakness that would be exploited by Xenos, but this was seen as an acceptable trade. The Imperials had attempted further assaults upon the Vengeful Spirit prior to the engagement of the Eldari stealth ship, and this had further decimated the Imperial naval assets. But the Vol's Ghost was no mere Eldar ship with stealth technology. It was also supported by typically Eldar psychic warding that complemented the more physical mechanics of its stealth capabilities. This prevented Chaos Sorcerers aboard the Vengeful Spirit from detecting its approach until it was far too late. As the small ship crashed into the Vengeful Spirit at ramming speed, all six Deathstrike missiles detonated in a chain explosion. The blast ripped a gaping maw in the side of the ancient vessel, not to mention the vortex warheads that formed a whirling maelstrom that began to tear the ship apart and suck it into the void. It could not simply escape by material power. The ship could not stand here, but it was anyone's guess as to how long before the vortex itself would shred the ship to pieces as it tore it into the warp. An emergency warp translation was its only possibility for salvation. The Chaos forces that remained continued to fight, but they were broken in many ways by now. In some locations, those such as the World Eaters would put up a devastating assault upon Imperial positions, including those of the Mechanicus,
but there were enough of the Imperial forces, including Astartes, Guard and Mechanicus, to focus where necessary and drive back the heretics, who are now in a state of uncoordinated withdrawal. But what of the situation more broadly? It was certainly a positive that the War Master had been forced to retreat, but the destruction laid upon the Blackstone stockpiles had surely already doomed Vigilus, and indeed the Nachmund Gauntlet. Well, thankfully, this was only partially correct. Had the Chaos forces of Abaddon been able to remain on Vigilus and scour the world proper, then it is certain they would have eradicated all the protective materials from Vigilus, and then closed the passageway. Yet, as is often the case when it comes to the Mechanicus, they had known better than to put all their eggs in one basket, so to speak. For they had concealed several other caches of Blackstone. These the Chaos traitors never detected. Alongside this, there was also still a great deal of the actual mineral itself buried into the crust of Vigilus. Thus, the ability of the world to hold open the bridge or corridor which spanned the Great Rift had certainly been diminished, but not destroyed. Within the population centres of Vigilus itself, the great city of Hyperia remained contested, while the sprawls of Otek and Dirkton were effectively written off now as unsalvageable. Battles still existed within them, but these were mostly salvaging efforts or attempts to retreat without sustaining significant material losses. Dontoria, as we know, was already considered lost, but it was externally quarantined. In the more polar regions of the world, Calyx Bane, which hadn't been thought of for some time, had become significantly colder due to the bizarre environmental ravages unleashed upon Vigilus, and it remained a conflict zone, some of which may have been due to Abaddon, but the Drakari here had also unleashed bizarre technology of their own. They had also travelled far from this area, and unlike early in the conflict where they attempted to remain in the shadows, the Imperium held such little effective control now of Vigilus, the Dark Eldar were just raiding fallen hive sprawls with minimal if any resistance. And their victims even included among their number some amount of Astartes, who were transported in plain sight back to the gateways which led to Kamora. The Eldar similarly began to retreat at this point. Their objectives were largely achieved, the blood debt against the Council of the Human Nobility settled, they were able to return to their craft worlds. The loss of the stealth ship Vol's Ghost was a notable sacrifice, but one which was unavoidable and clearly had proven its value many times over in this conflict. Of the orcs, though, it's more difficult to paint a clear picture, which seems about right for orcs. Often when an orc war has spiralled into a broad, confusing assault upon a planet, it will either rise to a level which consumes a world, or it will begin to diffuse itself through loss of momentum. Upon Vigilus, it seems the latter was true. With so many different enemies deploying such a host of different tactics, weaponry and objectives, the orcs were really unable to effectively make any significant headway. They inflicted massive damage, they were problematic, but really they had no central focus as to where to attack at any given time. Also, their losses had been far more significant than they ever would have been able to quantify, and while the wastelands of Vigilus, as is typical for so many Imperial worlds, would contain an element of Orc raiders for likely centuries if not thousands of years to come, the survivors disappeared into clouds of dust and trails which led off far into the uninhabitable wastelands of the planet. Distant scans suggested their scrap cities still remained viable, but this was an issue to be concerned with far down the line, as the Imperials certainly did not have the material capability to deal with this at the current period. But more troubling and unknown to the Imperials would be the fact that the Orcs had somehow transmitted the fact that a right good scrap was being having here on Vigilus. And even as the traitors and twisted mutants were being exterminated still, Orc hordes in other systems had begun to set course for Vigilus. As for the gene-stealer cults of the Pauper Princes, their efforts had been impressive, but ultimately they had overplayed their hand too early in the conflict. They were contained now within the sprawl of Dirkton, and while they controlled it top to bottom,
they had very little resources or ability to expand beyond this. They were effectively quarantined, and only in time would the full resolution come to them. For now, they watched the skies of Vigilus, hoping that the fleet of their Xenos masters would come, if ever. So the Imperium had clung on to achieve a Pyrrhic victory. While the propaganda officers within the ranks of Imperial Guard spun stories of glory and victory against the very worst enemies of humanity, the ravaged world, nearly completely destroyed by the heretics and Xenos alike, told a very visible, different story. Not to mention the Astartes and Mechanicus forces, withered by this conflict that had bled every stationed Imperial faction so very severely. They were now barely combat effective. Most critically, though, Abaddon's great plan to close the Nachmund Gauntlet had failed. And while Vigilus was little more than a huddled group of survivors, survive they did. Certainly long enough that they would hear the most morale-raising vox news since the retreat of the Vengeful Spirit. Communications had been established through the corridor, and they were now in contact with the Imperial fleets in Sanctus. Yet what was not widely known were the visions seen through those astropathic communications. For while the light of the Emperor could be seen and established, they also saw in the visions through the gauntlet a monstrous evil, a being first seen during a battle for the stars themselves, its ability to destroy a world with blazing lance covered in the blood of a holy crucible. For clarity, it's worth remembering that the Imperium communicates long distance with psykers, and those psykers known as astropaths, rarely receive clear information. Instead, they will receive visions which have to be interpreted as to their meaning. Sometimes these may be contaminated, or they may pick up extra information in that process. In this instance, the visions collected were to be heavily scrutinized. The battle for the stars would be interpreted as the 12th Black Crusade of Abaddon, known as the Gothic War. Sangua Terra was the sister world to Vigilus and stood at the Sanctus side of the Nachmund Gauntlet. This was the Holy Crucible. And the lance weapon was interpreted to mean that of a vessel once wielded by Abaddon. Its name, the Planet Killer. This ship was discovered by the Warmaster sometime after the 10th Black Crusade. It was a highly unusual ship classification built around a central energy cannon of apocalyptic power. The appropriately named Armageddon gun was capable of firing an energy beam that could cut deep through the planetary crust into the mantle of a world, causing incomprehensible scales of destruction. Upon the world of Saraven, the ship inflicted a continent-sized wound which saw the planet move from its natural orbit, flipping over its axis, and eventually collapsed in on itself. The ship's origins remain a mystery, for no record of such a vessel exists in the Imperium, nor does it bear any resemblance to recorded ship designs. Some have speculated that the ship was constructed, therefore, within the Eye of Terror by Abaddon's forces, prior even to the Gothic War. It could have been thousands of years. Some among the Mechanicus have even gone so far as to suggest that its construction may not have been physically possible outside of warp space. But the astropathic message was clear enough. Where Abaddon had failed upon Vigilus, he intended to be successful at Sangua Terra. His ultimate goal remained to close the Nachmund Gauntlet.